Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the high number of toxic releases in the region. Andrew in High School has a new principal. Samantha Horton reports on a short-term lending bill that passed out of the Indiana Senate. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Tammy Silverman of the Indiana Youth Institute. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Two counties in northwest Indiana have seen the highest number of toxic releases in more than a decade, despite a national decline, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. The Toxics Release Inventory National Analysis released Tuesday found Lake County had 378 toxic releases in 2017, while Porter County had 134. The Post Tribune reports, those are the largest amounts of on-site releases of toxins the counties have seen since 2003. Information was collected on chemicals released into the air, water, or soil from about 21,000 facilities across the country. The 49 in Lake County released more than 26 million pounds of material, while the 28 in Porter County released about 3.8 million pounds of material. The facilities with the highest number of releases in the two counties were BP Products in Whiting, Trade B Treatment and Recycling in East Chicago, ArcelorMittal in East Chicago, ArcelorMittal in Burns Harbor, and U.S. Steel Gary Works. The report included an incident when U.S. Steel in Portage spilled hexavalent chromium, a potentially carcinogenic chemical, into Lake Michigan in April 2017. On a national level, the analysis found that water releases have declined 70% since 2003, while air releases have declined 25%. Alexandra Dunn, the EPA's Assistant Administrator for Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, said in a statement, quote, "This year's TRI results give proof that economic growth and an improved environment can go hand in hand." Dunn goes on to say about 4,000 pollution prevention controls were enacted at the facilities. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Lake County Council is considering a new policy that would cut down its workload. Councilman Charlie Brown proposed a new policy that would allow departments to move money between budget line items without requiring council approval. The proposed policy would let county departments transfer money only if it's below $500. Brown said he's trying to remove some of the council's headaches by taking small transfers off the agendas. The Post Tribune reports since January, the council has reviewed five transfers that would fall below the threshold set by the proposed policy. Those transfers were for $4.50, $17.50, $30, $151.96, and $500. Brown said he's eager to see how much time and effort getting the small transfer off the agenda will save. Brown goes on to say that limitations would be put on what departments can transfer. Departments can transfer $500 between line items only twice each quarter without council approval. The new policy would exclude moving money related to salaries and not allow any transfers during the final quarter of the year without council approval. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Andrean's new principal is Dean of Students, Jacob Nauser. The appointment is part of a staff shuffle announced on his website late Wednesday. Former principal Tony Bonta was named as president of Andrean High School, a role where he will concentrate on plans to build a new high school. Nauser, 32, of Cedar Lake, has been a social studies teacher there since 2013. He is a 2005 Andrean graduate. He earned a bachelor's degree in political science and history and master's in history, both from Valparaiso University. Bonta said in a letter posted on the school website, quote, "I have been honored to serve as acting administrator, then principal of Andrean High School since May 1st, 2016. He goes on to say, "In my role as president, I will focus my full-time energy on supporting and implementing the Andrean Initiative for a new campus and collaborating with the Andrean High School development team, Andrean alumni, and Andrean stakeholders to enhance our relationships and philanthropic support of Andrean." Nauser will run the school with assistant principal and athletic director, Kelly Fitzgerald. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Steel, oil refinery, and auto parts workers in Northwest Indiana are getting their first pay raises in years, and an economist says their biggest paychecks will boost the region's economy by giving people more disposable income to spend. The Times reports steel workers at ArcelorMittal and U.S. Steel will receive 14% raises over the next 4 years, while workers at BP Whiting Refinery will get 11% raises over the next 3 years. Workers at Lear's seat-making factories also secured unspecified wage increases. Mike Millsap, the union's District 7 director, said the United Steelworkers Union is proud of the raises the workers were able to secure. Micah Pollack, an assistant professor of economics at Indiana University Northwest, says the raises will give a, quote, shot in the arm to the area's economy by giving workers more money to spend at local businesses. The raises also point to a recovery in the region's industrial sector. The region also saw strong overall economic growth last year with a 2.3% growth rate that was more than double that of the two previous years. Pollack goes on to say, whether that growth continues over the long term will depend both on how long the nation's current trade war and anti-globalization settlement continues and how the political and financial uncertainty that's forecast for 2019 plays out.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Police in Gary are asking the public for any information that could help them address an increase in homicides and gun violence this year. The Times reports there have been a dozen homicides so far this year in the city compared to 9 this time last year. There have been 18 people wounded by gunfire, up from a dozen this time last year. Among the victims were 3 members of the same family who were killed in separate attacks within days of each other. Police have yet to say if the deaths of Jimmy Valentine, his wife Tracy Valentine, and his brother Wayne Valentine are connected. Coroners say the cause of their deaths remains under investigation. Police Chief Richard Allen asked the public to come forward with tips. The department is increasing efforts to monitor high crime areas by partnering with other law enforcement groups, including the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Team, the Gang Response Investigative Team, and the Lake County Drug Task Force. Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson said the department is addressing drug issues in the city through undercover operations, data analysis, and anonymous tips. The department is also using an emergency hiring process to increase its workforce. It's unclear whether the department will get the funds for the new hires as the city is facing a budget crunch. Freeman Wilson's administration asked the department in December to cut more than $1 million from its budget.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Critics say an Indiana bill that would change the state's redistricting rules doesn't do enough to end gerrymandering. The Indianapolis Star reports the bill, sponsored by Republican State Senator Greg Walker, would allow lawmakers to continue drawing the state's legislative and congressional district maps for the foreseeable future. Redistricting occurs every 10 years in conjunction with the U.S. Census. The proposal would require lawmakers to create geographically compact districts and avoid dividing places like cities or school districts. Lawmakers would also be banned from considering where incumbents live and would be required to provide reasons behind any deviations. Walker said that while he doesn't believe the current districts are gerrymandered, he believes the proposed provisions help add accountability and make the process more transparent. The measure recently passed the Indiana Senate. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Tim Linane of Indianapolis said he supported the bill, but he would have preferred to create an independent commission because it's clear the state's maps are gerrymandered. Government transparency advocates have been pushing to have an independent committee take over the redistricting process so the political party in power doesn't gain an unfair advantage. Julia Vaughn, policy director for the political watchdog group Common Cause, said that while the current proposal doesn't do enough, quote, it's better than nothing. Vaughn goes on to say, quote, redistricting reform is a two-part equation. Who draws the maps and how do they draw them? We'd like to have at least one of those things. She goes on to say, there always is the possibility that as you go through the session, you can make the bill stronger.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland seems to have changed his mind about what should be done with the area where the former West Calumet Public Housing Complex once stood. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, it's unclear if that will change the Environmental Protection Agency's cleanup plans for the site.
Copeland's original input led the EPA to add a contingency to its plan, which would have allowed the lead and arsenic contaminated site to be cleaned to less stringent commercial industrial standards. But in a recent letter, the mayor says he supports a residential cleanup and also sides with the majority of residents who want all of the contamination gone. But Maritza Lopez, who chairs a concerned citizens group in East Chicago, says the EPA still recommended cleaning the soil only up to 2 feet deep at its most recent meeting.
I think they play games. I'll be upfront. And I'm saying as a resident.
The EPA could decide to change its cleanup plan for the former housing complex after reviewing the public comments due March 13th. We couldn't reach Mayor Copeland or the EPA for an interview. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. New data from state officials shows the number of mass layoffs in Indiana has fallen so far this year compared to the same time last year. According to the Indiana Department of Workforce Development, during the first 2 months of 2019, Indiana companies reported 4 mass layoffs through the Workers Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act. The Times reports that's down from 15 at the same time last year and 10 at the same time in 2017. Department data shows 432 Indiana workers lost jobs in mass layoffs so far this year. That's compared with 2,626 workers during January and February of 2018 and more than 3,000 during the same time in 2017. The Times reports January and February are common times for mass layoffs as companies try to cut costs if they're struggling while entering a new fiscal year. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Data from the state of Indiana show more public high school students are taking advanced placement exams. The Times reported Monday that the Indiana Department of Education announced last month that about 1,200 more students in the class of 2018 took AP exams than in previous year's graduating class. Data also show the rate of students earning a passing grade or higher increased 12.6% in the last 3 years. Indiana Commissioner of Higher Education Teresa Looper says the trend is encouraging because, quote, early college credit leads to higher success rates and cost savings for students and the state. AP courses are modeled from comparable college courses. The College Board prepares the exams, and students who earn high scores can receive college credit.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The guidance counselor suspended from an Indianapolis Catholic high school because of her marriage to a woman has filed a second discrimination charge against the school. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Carter Barrett has more.
In January, suspended Roncalli High School guidance counselor Shelley Fitzgerald filed a discrimination claim with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Last week, she filed a second claim that says the school retaliated against her when it asked her father not to volunteer at a school retreat. Her claim says the school wanted to, quote, punish and dissuade her from pursuing further action. Her father, Pat Fitzgerald, has volunteered at the retreat for 26 years. The Archdiocese of Indianapolis and Roncalli High School said in a statement they are grateful for Pat Fitzgerald's volunteer work, but say his participation in the public protest around his daughter's suspension would be a distraction for students at the retreat. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Carter Barrett.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb, State School Superintendent Jennifer McCormick, and State Treasurer Kelly Mitchell are encouraging high school students to apply for the 2019 Governor's STEM Team. The program honors 4 outstanding high school students for their exemplary performance in one of the STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Nominees are also judged on extracurricular activities, work or research projects, leadership, and community service. Winning students students each receive a $1,000 college scholarship from Indiana's College Choice 529 Direct Savings Plan and letter jackets identifying them as members of the STEM team. The nominations may be submitted online. The deadline is March 31st. Nominations will be reviewed by teachers, college and university instructors, and state education staff. The STEM team complements Indiana's Mr. and Ms. Math and Science Awards.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More than 100,000 Hoosiers live with Alzheimer's disease, and that number is expected to rise by 18% by 2025. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports a new report on the disease highlights the need for better detection.
Only 16% of seniors receive a cognitive assessment during a routine checkup, according to the 2019 Alzheimer's Disease Facts and Figures Report. The analysis highlights the disconnect between patients and doctors about initiating an evaluation. Maria Holmes, a care consultant with the Alzheimer's Association Greater Indiana chapter, says stigma is still a factor.
But if people don't raise their concerns, they're going to miss an opportunity, and they're going to be much more likely to find themselves in a crisis if they don't sort of step up and have that conversation with a doctor.
Less than half of providers say they screen for cognitive impairment in patients over 65. Early detection of Alzheimer's and dementia can help prepare patients and caregivers to live with the disease. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indiana scientist has helped develop a new type of synthetic DNA and says it might help astrobiologists think differently about alien life. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports.
The synthetic DNA is called hachimochi, in Japanese hachi meaning eight and moji meaning letter, a reference to the DNA's eight-letter structure, more than the normal four. It was developed with the help of Dr. Millie Georgiadis from the Indiana University School of Medicine. She says the research was funded by NASA and aims to reimagine molecular structure.
So rather than limiting your search to what you see on this planet, you can think about other types of molecules that still have the same properties and yet are not chemically the same.
Hachimoji DNA acts as natural DNA does to support life through informational building blocks. The synthetic system is not self-sustaining. Scientists say it could prove effective for other applications, including diagnosis and drug development. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana tech industry leaders say the lack of a comprehensive hate crimes law is a barrier to attracting new talent. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports those lawmakers say they're ready to engage with lawmakers to advance the issue.
Many in the business community want a hate crimes bill with a list of victim characteristics, and they were upset when Senate Republicans eliminated that list earlier this session. Clear Software CEO John Gilman says if House lawmakers don't add it back in, they'll give Indiana a, quote, black eye.
Just simply reaffirms the reputation of Indiana as being socially regressive and essentially not inclusive.
Clear Object CEO John McDonald is on the board of the Indiana Technology and Innovation Association. He says he wants tech companies to dispel the myth that Hoosiers don't care about the hate crimes debate.
Get engaged with their local legislators and help them understand the importance of this issue, not on sort of a wide scale, but specifically in that district to those companies.
House GOP leaders are not supportive of a hate crimes law with a list of victim characteristics, though Governor Eric Holcomb has advocated for one. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The fight to reinstate higher net metering rates in Indiana may not be over yet. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, a Democratic senator says he's not ready to give up on a bill that would give people with solar power panels more money for delivering excess energy to the grid.
The bipartisan bill didn't get a hearing in the Senate Utilities Committee. It's chaired by Republican Senator Jim Merritt, who passed the original law to phase down net metering. But at a renewable energy rally at the State House, Senator J.D. Ford says he's going to try to add the language of his bill into a House amendment.
I reject the General Assembly's attempt and inability to accept legislation that will better support renewable energy.
Several speakers at the rally talked about the role renewable energy plays in public health and in bringing jobs to the state. Environmentalists also favor a bill that wouldn't allow homeowners associations to prevent property owners from installing solar panels. They're against a proposal that would allow utilities to more quickly recover the cost of certain projects from customers' bills. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The State Board of Education Wednesday ordered two Indianapolis schools under state intervention to transition into charter schools instead of closing them down. But Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Eric Weddle says uncertainties remain.
The board voted 7-3 for Thomas Carr Howe and Emmerich Manuel High Schools to exit state intervention in mid-2020 and become charter schools. The schools were previously part of Indianapolis Public Schools District when they were taken over by the state for chronic academic failure. But IPS leaders are worried they can run into financial trouble if the charter manager can lease or buy the schools for $1 under a state law. State board member David Freitas says they can figure that out later.
Unleash Charter USA to go after these charters and let them continue that process.
The company running Howe and Manuel, Charter Schools USA, could seek the charters as early as next week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
State lawmakers are one step closer to allowing pharmacists to deny women access to abortion-inducing drugs. Current law lets doctors and hospital employees refuse to provide or participate in abortion services. Proposed legislation would extend that to nurses, physician assistants, and pharmacists. Pharmacist John Volova says healthcare providers shouldn't have to check their morality at the door.
Why then should we require healthcare providers to participate in procedures they feel are ethically or morally reprehensible?
But pharmacist Ashley Meredith says the bill provides no protection for patients.
There is no exception for a woman with serious or immediate health risks. No provisions are included for ensuring that the patient gets the needed care or even a referral to an unbiased provider in a timely manner.
The House Public Health Committee advanced the bill 9-4 along party lines.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Researchers across the country, including a few in Indiana, have put together a plan that could transform the U.S.-Mexico border in a different approach to the wall President Trump is calling for. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the plan outlines an energy park that its creators say would create economic opportunities for both countries.
The proposal encourages public-private partnerships to build up the wind, solar, and natural gas infrastructure on the border, and in turn increase the land's value. Researchers argue border security would be addressed because the utility facilities would be well protected by fencing, electronic sensors, and drones. Purdue University Professor Luciano Castillo says the plan should be able to pay back building costs and then some, unlike the president's wall proposal.
The economic value that this is adding to the region, the taxes, the generation, that is the incentive that we see that will help pay for the cost of this infrastructure.
Castillo argues bringing job opportunities to the region will also help limit illegal immigration. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
As the first half of the 2019 lawmaking session wrapped up, a bill limiting payday lenders died, while another allowing different types of high-interest loans passed out of the Indiana Senate. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the surviving bill's author says he wants to fill a hole in the industry, and industry opponents say already helps more than it hurts.
Huntington Republican Senator Andy Zay says Hoosiers are struggling with credit.
Unfortunately, 20% of Hoosiers have a credit score of less than 550. These Hoosiers presently borrow over $1 billion in excess of 1 million loans.
His suggestion to fix this? Expanding loan options not currently available in Indiana. Zay contends it's a problem that there's no middle interest rate loan type available.
Right now, there's a huge gap that takes you from about 36% to 391%, so there's nothing in between there. And that's the whole purpose of this product, is to try and create some stair steps, try and create a gradual way out of it.
That's 391% figure. That's the current cap on payday lending interest in Indiana, a type of financial instrument many consumer advocates say is predatory and marketed primarily to low-income individuals. The concept is simple. Get a short-term loan before the next paycheck arrives in exchange for paying the cash back on payday with interest. A lot of interest in many cases. So much that it often adds up to many times the size of the original loan, if it keeps compounding. It's a cycle that can destroy credit, not build it, as Zay argues. A bill to cap Indiana's rate at 36% failed in the first half of the legislative session, amid concerns that such a move would send consumers to unscrupulous lenders. Then, Zay's bill creating more of the middle interest rate loans narrowly passed. Senate Minority Leader Tim Lannon wasn't sold, though. He sees it as another way to allow lenders to rates above the limit already set in state law.
We still have, to the best of my knowledge, a statute which prohibits these usurious rates of interest, but every time we create these type of products, we have to say, oh, but not for these products. These are okay to charge people rates above what we have traditionally have said are illegal rates to actually charge.
Columbus Republican Senator Greg Walker, whose 36% cap bill failed, says debt used to be talked about seriously.
And we talk about, you know, what this debt does to mortgage our future. And whether we're speaking as a nation or as a state or as an individual household, debt is still enslavement.
So far, 16 states and the District of Columbia have enacted a 36% or less cap on payday lending interest rates. Indiana Institute for Working Families' Aaron Macy says such a move has driven bad actors out of the market in those areas.
In states that do that, we find that borrowers engage in a variety of other options that are often much less costly and more productive for them than a payday loan would be.
Purdue University economist Kevin Mumford has researched payday lending caps and says it's a simple formula. When reasonable interest rates allow people to pay their loans back in full, it's not as profitable for lenders who rely on making money from a cycle of debt building on debt.
That's why when it gets down too low, the lenders just drop out of the market.
Mumford's data indicates Zay may be right. A cap somewhere below the current 391% might still be better for consumers, but also not cause businesses to fold. Governor Eric Holcomb told reporters that after reading the lending bills, one word came to mind: heartburn. But he says it's still too early for him to decide if he would veto any legislation on the matter.
It just didn't wear well with me.
While disappointed with the outcome in the Senate, Prosperity Indiana Policy Director Kathleen Laura says her group, which advocates ways to get Hoosiers out of poverty, will continue to speak out against such lending as the one surviving bill makes its way through the House.
I think people are really grappling with very real questions about how do we provide ample credit access to subprime borrowers. We just really want that conversation to be driven by policy and data at the community level. What are we seeing for consumers? What would provide them that step up on the economic ladder and not cut up the rungs from underneath them as they're trying to build their credit?
Hoosiers currently take out more than 1 million payday loans a year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Health researchers in Indiana are knocking on doors to collect surveys and DNA samples. A growing number of studies factor in zip code when considering health outcomes. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports for the leaders of this study, the aim is to deepen our understanding of those findings.
Many factors impact health, including genetics, lifestyle habits, the physical and social environment.
And knowing how that place where they live, the kind of place where they live, not specifically where they live, works to their advantage of their genetic inheritance or not.
Indiana University professor Bernice Pesca-Salido leads the IU person-to-person health interview study that looks at how different factors interact.
We really need that interaction for this next phase of science, which looks at them as a whole person, not just the disease in the body and the bed.
IU Health field interviewer Paula Williamson gets out of her big black pickup.
We are in a neighborhood of modular homes in Noblesville.
She's been knocking on doors for the past few months as part of the IU person-to-person health study. She says people have been very receptive.
There's part ownership in this project that people want their voices to be heard.
Williamson says she asks about family, personal health history, behaviors, lifestyle, mental health, drug use, healthcare access, and childhood experiences. Not everyone agrees to the DNA sample. And when it comes to giving the genetic sample, participants are given an extra $25.
Hi. Hi, Sandra.
Hi.
Sandra Jo Edwards lives in an apartment on the south side of Indianapolis. She had a little trouble filling the sample tube up with spit.
Actually, I was really like, okay. Actually, I couldn't even get it out, though, because it was so hard. I couldn't drink nothing or anything, so.
When Edwards first received an invitation to participate in the person-to-person study, she threw it away.
I just thought it was just something, you know, that come from, you know, wherever, and I was like, I'm not going to do this.
But then Paula Williamson knocked on her door. She started thinking about her parents, her possible health path, and that of her children. Both of Edwards' parents had cancer. Her mother is a survivor. Her father passed away.
You know, my father, I mean, he just did it himself, though. You know, he didn't want to go do the treatments or anything like that. So he just, but that's on him, not me.
Her information will be compiled with others around the state to give a clearer, deeper look at why one person develops a condition and another does not. Professor Bernice Pesca-Salido says this study could add to emerging research that suggests place plays a big role.
The social environment can either turn on protective genes or it can turn off protective genes. And so social factors like loneliness, social factors like childhood traumas, these things have been scientifically shown to affect whether or not they're going to get certain kinds of diseases.
Pesca-Salido says her trial goes to the source, the people, and asks more.
Because even if you come up with the most brilliant prevention strategies, if the people who you're targeting don't want it, don't like the way you're doing it, it's going to be useless.
This study aims to recruit at least 2,000 participants from across the state. It's part of a larger Indiana University Precision Health Initiative with a 2020 goal of curing at least one cancer, one childhood disease, and finding a preventative solution to a chronic illness. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Whitney Reynolds Show is dedicated to provoking positive change through tough topics. The mission should really be considered a personal mantra. The show, which began as an online talk show, within its first year quickly earned a slot on a major broadcast network. For the last 7 years, it has called PBS its home. Whitney Reynolds is the executive producer, host, and owner of the show. Whitney, thanks for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
It is such an honor to be with you guys.
First, can you just tell us a little bit about what inspired your vision for the Whitney Reynolds Show?
Yeah, so I've always been good at TV. From a young age, I knew that's what I was going to do. But when I was growing up in a small town in Oklahoma, my family went through a semi-tragic event, and it really shaped me. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s and I was in the career of television that I realized that I wasn't given that as a little kid on accident. It was a very clear vision that I was called to create a show where people know their topics, similar to mine, no matter what it may be, is safe. And we are going to give people hope and inspiration through whatever comes our way.
Now, Monday, March 25th, the Whitney Reynolds Show will premiere its 9th season, which, by the way, is no small feat. Now, how has your show evolved since its early days?
Well, I always say people grew up literally with me. I started this show when I was 23. I stepped into our mission around the age of 26. And with that, it's been kind of climbing the ladder, but in a very public way. And when I say that is, you know, I'm 32 now. I've had babies with my viewers, not literally on TV, but, you know, y'all have grown up with me and you've seen me evolve into this woman and talk show host that I have become. And it's been really special to see, you know, now that we're launching season 9, and this is one of my favorite seasons yet. And I say that because these topics, now that we're in season 9, we have viewers from all over submit ideas and come into Chicagoland to tape these topics, and it's absolutely amazing. So this season is really powerful with just what's going to unfold on our set. And then also, we launched in a new market starting this spring. So now we're in 6 states. and four markets. So I'm so pumped. I actually have Amy Schumer on the show, and we talk about loving yourself from the inside out and what that really looks like, because so often the world tells us what we should look like or what we should feel about ourselves. And this show is saying, you know what, your self-image really comes from within, and it's a really beautiful way to kick everything off.
What's a better way to kick off the season than to celebrate women with two of the funniest women in show business right now? Now, you said you had Amy Schumer and A.D. Bryant.
Yeah, so they were off for their new movie, and it was interesting because we went with the angle of self-image. There's so many aspects to it. I mean, being a public figure, I get it, because when you put yourself out there, no matter if it's on social media, TV, you're going to get some good feedback, but you're also putting yourself out there where people can say things back to you that might not be so kind. And so with that, we kind of touch on all those points of just self-image. The movie I Feel Pretty was all about that. It's one of those things that she realizes in the movie that she's beautiful all along, and it didn't take any changing. And that's what we really delve into with that interview. On that show, we also have a woman who came over, was adopted from India, had polio, and they had to take her arm muscles and put them in her legs. And now she is a model on a national campus.
Wow, how cool is that?
It is so cool. Yeah, when she was growing up, she would watch commercials and say, why do I not see any girls that look like me on there? And she decided to change it. So this show, Self-Image, is just like, okay, let's just open it all up with the inspiration and letting people know that they truly are beautiful just the way they are. And sometimes we need that reminder.
Absolutely. Do me a favor and just give me a sneak peek of what else do you have on deck for this season?
So we have a yearly Women Entrepreneur Show, and every year we do a unique twist with it. And this year it's junior entrepreneurs, and there are just so many amazing young women that are on this set that are talking to, you know, kind of the young dreamers and showing people they can do it. We have a vlogger from the South. We have two girls that developed a safe and sound spray is what it's called. And it helps if you're being attacked on a college campus or anywhere, actually, you can spray it. And not only does it sound an alarm, but the dye stays on the person for 48 hours. And I think in this day and age, you know, all the Me Too stuff that's come up for men and women, it's such a great, I mean, this product couldn't have come at a more timely time. And they were 16 when they developed it. And that's what's really cool about that one. And then we have social media impact. And this show was super interesting because we're all kind of growing up in this social media age. But really, we look at the mental component and what it could be doing. And we even hear from a doctor how people are trying to change themselves for social media. And that show, if you have ever questioned where you think we're going or what's going on social media, or ever wondered, like, is it weird that I want to check my status? This is the show to tune into. That one actually comes on April 8th. That's a must watch because it's just super interesting. And we have a lot of experts on to walk us through kind of what's happened in the last 10 years or so when it comes to kind of our need to be online. We have reinventions. And what I love about this show, it really declares that it's not over until it's over. And no matter what stage of life you're in, you can always find your next journey if you look. And on April 29th, we sit down, very, very powerful interview with one woman. We're talking with Angela Rose. And Angela Rose, she is one that I will forever think of whenever I think of people that have taken what cards they were given and has just used them to help others to an extreme level. And Angela Rose was taken by knife point from the mall, and she was sexually assaulted and somehow got away and has now created an organization that is helping victims know that they too can survive this and thrive in life through what she went through. It is a very hard episode, but it's also really important to understand that this is a person that went through something very difficult. And on the other side, it's like, you can be okay. And now you can make this a platform to help others. And she is doing that day in and day out. And it wasn't always pretty. And she let us know that, but there's so much hope in her story. And that's what we find out in that show. But, you know, I want to invite everyone because we have a premiere party. So if you're listening to Lakeshore Public Radio, I want you to be at our premiere party. It's on the 25th at the Jay Parker. The tickets are free. It's going to be amazing. It's a rooftop view, but you have to register to get them. So they have to go to WhitneyReynolds.com/contact and just put in their info for those tickets.
Whitney, thanks for joining us.
Who made the stars, baby, that's just who we are. Take back
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Tammy Silverman of the Indiana Youth Institute.
The Indiana Youth Institute puts out its Kids Count data book. In fact, the 25th anniversary edition of the Kids Count data book has just come out. It's an opportunity to be able to see how the status of Indiana's children and youth is. And there's always some very serious questions and things to bring up, but it also helps spur along a lot of discussion and conversation out in the communities as well, too. Let's check in with Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, the IYI, about the latest Kids Count data book. And Tammy, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's go through the general explanation first about what the Kids Count book is, the data book's all about here. Many people probably heard this reference, but they don't really understand how it comes together, the information that you all at the IYI gather to be able to put this thing together, and then what in turn it's going to be able to do in general terms for kind of pushing the conversation along on ways to help Indiana's youth.
Absolutely. So again, like you said, for 25 years, we've been pulling together information with the idea that for us to be able to really help kids, we need to have some current accurate data on how they're faring. And so we pull together information from a lot of the different state agencies. So the Department of Education, the Department of Children's Services, the Department of Corrections, you know, all of those things, public health, as well as many other sources that have been vetted and, you know, are tested for reliability and all those kinds of things. So we pull all that together, and then we really go through and put it in, hopefully, an order that folks find usable. So it's broken down into four categories: family and community, economic well-being, education, and health. And it looks at those areas across the state of Indiana.
I know that a lot of this work is really just putting data together, but I would imagine, as you just mentioned here, that there are a lot of various places where it is available out there, and the average person is not going to be able to check out every single source and put things together. So this brings things together in one easy-to-understand piece, does it not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, when we started doing this 25 years ago, they said it wasn't that easy to get it. You know, you couldn't just hop on the computer and search data. And the reality is you can now, but just as you said, sometimes it's really hard to track down. It's really hard to know what's the most current resources, and it's really hard to get some of those different points together. So by pulling it all together, we're hoping, and we often hear great feedback, that people do find it a source that they can use for all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. Most commonly, you know, nonprofits use it to raise funds and to justify and get some of their grants. And then our policymakers, we were just at the State House a couple of days ago, and they said they use it a lot to inform new legislative policies or administrative policies.
I know a lot of people probably, especially new lawmakers, may or may not be familiar with some of the details of some of this, and they're focusing primarily on the bigger picture, and sometimes they probably need a little help in understanding these things.
They do. They do. And they're eager to get it. I will say we're spending several days this month at the State House doing what we're calling data and donuts and setting up between the two chambers and, you know, provide really those county snapshots. A lot of our elected leaders want to know not only the state information, but what exactly is happening in their area of the state that they represent. And then we can also do custom data requests. So, for example, if there's a senator or representative that is involved in a particular bill, say on education or on juvenile justice, we can drill down with them on that data to provide them the most current information so that they can take that into their committee hearings.
Okay, Tammy, let's go into a little more detail here, and we'll take a look at data from Lake and from Porter counties in particular here. We know that to be able to improve the well-being of children and youth in the state as well as in Northwest Indiana, you have to first understand the current reality. Let's talk about what the current reality seems to be on the topic of family and community.
Family and community, we know that one of the most critical issues here is the number of children who live with someone that has a problem with drugs or alcohol. And again, that takes into account the opioid crisis, and we've seen that impact on kids. The national average is 8.5%, and in Indiana, we're a little higher than that with 9.2%. So that equates to one out of every 11 children. And so again, this is something that we're looking at as well as in family and community. It looks at the number of children, the abuse rates for abuse and neglect. And unfortunately, in your area, that has gone up over the last 3 years from about 12% to right at about 20%. Mm-hmm. That is very consistent with the state average. So it has gone up, but it's not, you know, it's not any worse relative to the state.
On the issue of economic well-being, I know that, there's very serious concern because there are many young people out there that are in families that are well below, in some cases, the economic threshold, and they're trying to deal with life as a young person, and on top of that, in a family that may not have enough money to be able to keep enough food on the table or a proper place to stay.
You're right. You're right. And as we many of us know, raising a child does take some financial resources and can be expensive in many families. You know, we know that the unemployment rates throughout the state have gone down significantly over the past 3 years. One of the things that we're digging into and looking at is to what extent do those jobs provide enough financial resources. So we have a lot of folks that are underemployed, right? Or that maybe those jobs aren't providing a living wage. And so again, in order to have the resources to provide for kids, we need to look at, are those jobs the most productive financially, right? Mm-hmm. And so we know, again, in your area, the median household income has gone up over the last 3 years and is fairly consistent with the state average. The unemployment rates have gone down. And fortunately, it looks like there's a small decrease in the number of children living in poverty. So that, again, is going in the right direction. It is a little higher than the state average.
Now, how about housing costs? Because that's always part of it, too. If a family has to really scrape money together to be able to feed a family and take care of the family, some of that comes into whether they can find a comfortable place to live.
Right. And comparatively, Indiana is a fairly inexpensive place to live.
Yeah.
And again, that varies greatly from community to community and area to area. But overall, we are placed 10th nationally for the lowest housing costs. So again, you know, relative to other states and living where you all do, that part of the state, there's a lot of comparisons to Illinois. We're relatively inexpensive for housing costs.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman with the Indiana Youth Institute, taking a look at some of the information out of the 2019, the 25th anniversary edition of the Kids Count Data Book. On the subject of education, where do we seem to stand on that here across the state and here in Northwest Indiana?
Actually, education is our bright spot as far as the state goes. That overall child well-being in Indiana, we're ranked 28th in the country. For education, we're actually ranked 14th. And so what we're seeing and one of the biggest factors there is our 4th and 8th graders and their standardized tests in math and reading compared to their peers nationally. In your area, one of the really great pieces of news coming out of the data book is the fact that the number of high-quality early childhood care and education programs has more than doubled.
Wow.
In the last 3 years. So that's not to say that it's meeting all the needs that are out there, but again, there's been significant progress. And so, again, I think that if you talk to the teachers, if we talk to the educators that are out there, they would certainly say we still have room to go to make sure all the educational needs of our kids are being met. But in general, this has been an area that we've seen the most progress over the past 5 years.
Do we seem to find it particularly here in Lake County because it's one of the counties that has set up with the pre-K program? Are we doing very well for the very youngest people to get them off out of the home basically and into the classroom?
You bet, you bet. And that's exactly right. That's where we're seeing a lot of uptick. And we know that that access to those high-quality early childhood experiences pays off in the long run. So you guys are moving in the right direction, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of hope out there as far as what that means for the future continued success.
Now, obviously, the last category that's within the Kids Count data book deals with health. That's always the major concern, I know, for Hoosier young people and the family members as well, too. And I guess that's one of the areas we're probably working the hardest to try to correct, is it not?
It is. It is. And so, unfortunately, health is one of our biggest challenge areas. We're ranked, Indiana as a whole is ranked 31st. Nationally, when we look at prenatal care, we're doing all right. We're ranked 15th nationally, but the areas of biggest challenge are infant mortality and the number of children with health insurance. This also takes into account what the ratio is of access to mental health providers. And so, again, I think there's been a lot of discussion about infant mortality. We know that infants are more likely to die in their first year in Indiana than those in 42 other states. And when you break that down, black infants are additionally more than twice as likely to die before their first baby than white infants in Indiana. And so that is a critical issue that I know they're trying to address at the state level, but that is important for us all to pay attention to.
Are we finding, too, that when you get the children getting older, they're into past elementary school, into middle school or high school, you have the concerns, I guess, about their mental health as well as their physical health, don't you?
Absolutely. And so, again, one of the bright spots of news for your folks is the fact that that ratio of mental health providers has actually improved significantly over the past 3 years. So it used to be 1 to every 749 individuals. Now it's 1 to 630. So again, that's still a huge caseload, but it's much better than the state average. One of our areas that we continue to look at is, unfortunately, Indiana ranks second in the nation for the percentage of our teens who have contemplated or attempted suicide. And so we know that there's a correlation between that access to mental health provision, anxiety, and that risk factor for our kids.
Well, not only did we talk here about the data, looking statewide as well as here in Northwest Indiana, that's in the latest Kids Count data book. What recommendations, I guess, specifically call for recommendations for policymakers to look at, but obviously you want to nudge them in the right direction. What kinds of things does the IYI recommend that community leaders as well as legislative leaders do to try to make some improvement in some of these numbers?
Yep, you've got it. So really, the data is only as good as what we do with it, right? You know, we want to have accurate data, we want to have up-to-date data, but it's really about what do we do with it now, going forward. And so throughout the data book, for each one of these big sections, there are some recommendations, and there are recommendations for state leaders that are looking at policy, but also community leaders and also individuals, right? We can all play a role in improving the well-being of our kids. And so I would just encourage folks to take a look there and see where what issues are important to them and then what role they can play in helping increase the well-being of Indiana kids. Because we know for those of us who grew up here and who had, good experience as a child, we know that it's a possibility. It's possible for a child in Indiana to have a wonderful childhood. Unfortunately, we just don't have that yet for all of our kids, so there's more work to be done.
And we kind of mentioned it at the beginning of our conversation here about the fact that the information is all gathered together from the various sources. It's part of the 2019 Kids Count data book. If anybody would like to find out more, and particularly kind of drill down into the particular county data, which you can do too, it's all on IYI.org, is it not?
It is. It is. And so everything is available at your fingertip, both the entirety of the book as well as all the 92 county snapshots. In addition, if you still come up with questions, right, we have a data team that's available to have those conversations with you or a community group, right? If you want to have a conversation about why your community is ranked in a particular way in a particular category, we are more than happy to have those conversations.
I mean, sometimes we forget, too, that the IYI has staffers that branch out to various parts of the state, including Northwest Indiana, and they're more than happy to talk with organizations. You say about community groups that maybe have questions and the like, you can bring up some of this information, and you can have these conversations in a smaller group or a big room, whichever you choose, I guess, to talk about these issues.
Absolutely right. We will do about 40 presentations on this data book throughout the state over the next couple of months, everything from church groups to Rotary clubs to school corporations. Melanie Walker is the representative in your area, and she would be more than happy to have a discussion and get one of those presentations set up if that's of interest.
And as we say, you can always go to IYI.org, IYI.org, and find out more information. Look at the individual sections of data here, not only about Northwest Indiana, but the rest of the state as a whole. And as always, Tammy, thank you for spending time with us to give us a good overview of what the current, the 25th anniversary Indiana Youth Institute Kids Count data book has to say. And let's hope that some of the information, if it hasn't already, that shocks enough people into some action.
Thank you so much, Chris. We always appreciate your passion for helping Indiana's kids.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.